This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
This week, cataloging biodiversity.
We're at a situation of crisis, and we have no capacity to inventory biodiversity on the planet today, in my view, at the scale that we need to be able to do it. So we have to change the rules.
This week, a scientist's attempt to catalog species by DNA barcoding turns up surprises and criticism. Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and this is The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. First this week, make sure to vote for the best laboratory website. I have with me our staff writer, Andrea Garleski, who is coordinating the awards.
Hi, Carrie.
Hey. So tell me what the voting is for.
Okay, so we requested nominations for the best laboratory websites last month, and we got 60 nominations, and they were narrowed down, and now our judges have selected the top 10 websites. And they selected them based on how well each of those sites was designed, what kind of scientific content it had, how easy it was to navigate the page, and also how well it connected itself to other members in the scientific community, and you know whether it had Web 2.0 features like blogs and RSS feeds and that type of thing. So the judges narrowed it down to the top 10 sites, and so now the readers can go online and vote and choose their favorite lab websites. And there's actually a real interesting spread of sites. An interesting fact is that only three are based in the U.S., which is pretty remarkable. So out of the 10, only three in the U.S.
Where are the rest of them?
The rest are spread in Canada. There's one in Scotland, the U.K., Germany, British Columbia, Ontario. So it's pretty cool, a good spread. And they study all sorts of things from proteomics to marine biology, organogenesis, genomic diversity, and neurobiology. So it's an interesting group, and there's some really good pages up there.
What can you tell so far from going from the 60 to the 10? Like, what is it that makes a good website?
Sure. Well, in the design category, having a real clean-looking page where the viewer comes to the site and it's easy to see where you're supposed to go, what's to click on, information is easy to find, contact information is easy to find, yes, but also what is the lab researching? It's all sort of set up in a really user-friendly way. So that's one really important category that I noticed the judges looked at. Another was just how accessible is it for the community elements? Like, are lab members blogging? Do they have their own pages? Can you send an email easily to the group or to the PI? Are there interactive features, that kind of thing? And also, of course, the scientific content is really important. A lot of these pages are really jam-packed with not only just text explaining what the lab research is, but interactive videos, images, graphs, things like that that really engage people and pull you in. So it's not necessarily how flashy a website is, whether it uses high-tech web elements, but really is a good design that's easy to navigate, that's really engaging to the reader, but also is being very honest to the science that's going on, because that's really what's important there.
So how long is the voting open for?
Voting is open for one more week from today, so it'll end on December 4th, which is next Tuesday. So that'll be about 2 weeks of voting in all.
Okay. And then when will we find out who the winner is?
Well, the winners will be displayed hopefully a week after that. So the second week in December, we'll know who the winner is, and you'll be able to read all the judges' comments, and the judges also picked their favorite websites, but we haven't displayed those yet. So you'll be able to see how every page ranks and then who the judges picked, and we'll also be following up in the spring with a feature in our careers section on how to design the best website for your laboratory, if you're interested in doing that. It's obviously a great way to connect with the community and connect with readers and lay people and anyone who's interested in the science you're doing in your lab.
Good. And when will that be published?
In March.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Next up, available on the 1st, you can get the December issue of The Scientist, in which staff writer Bob Grant writes about attempts by scientists to catalog every species on Earth using a technique called DNA barcoding. The technique relies on a 650 base pair stretch of mitochondrial DNA in the gene cytochrome C oxidase 1, with the idea that each species will have a unique sequence. Paul A. Baer at the University of Guelph launched DNA barcoding in 2003, and since then numerous researchers have picked up on it. Grant traveled to Canada to meet with A. Baer, and he spoke with him about potential new species that have popped up from barcoding analyses. Here are excerpts from their interview.
So I could think of an example on Australian sharks, where the barcode results, there were interim species names. They thought these things might be different. We barcoded them. It reinforced their views, and those species were described. Hmm. So we've had cases in Canada where, I would say the number of species that have been identified now for the first time and gained a real name would be in the tens.
Right.
And I would say that by next year this time, it will probably be in the hundreds. And some of these things are very well-studied fishes, like the barramundi. I just got a letter from Bob Ward, my colleague in Australia, and they've been doing work with Southeast Asian fish and Australian fishes, and now they've got evidence the barramundi is split. A really important commercial fish, the John Dory, which is a very conspicuous marketplace fish around the world, it's splitting into two very divergent species. Oh, I mean, one of the interesting things we just found very recently, of all the moth species in North America that's been studied intensively, probably no moth species more intensively studied than the peppered moth, mm-hmm. Piston petularia, the thing that was all industrial melanism and all that. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing is it's not one species in North America, it's two species.
Oh, really?
And
how about in England?
Well, it appears there's only one species in Europe, but the interesting twist may be, and this is premature, but industrial melanism rose up in North America, and it turns out that one of the lineages now found across North America very close to a European lineage. We'll know within a couple of weeks if it's the same thing. And the tree on this one, but because of that result, we're now piling through, we're just getting specimens in from England, but it could be that the rise of industrial melanism in North America was due to a species introduction from Europe.
Oh, really?
Which would be a very interesting little story. So, even the best studied species, you know, things that you can't imagine people wouldn't have looked at carefully, like commercially important fishes or the most written about moth, mm-hmm. in North America, turns out not to be one species, but two.
Well, let me ask you to respond
yep.
to criticism I've heard along those lines.
Yep.
So I've heard some taxonomists say that what you've done is taken, sort of picked the lowest hanging fruit in doing barcoding on birds or lepidopterans that are very well characterized
yep.
taxonomically, and you sort of shied away from the tougher tests of less well-described species.
Well, you can't, I'd say that's a... they're not really understanding what we're doing. What we're doing now, and what we have been doing, is doing what had to be done first, which is ground truth in the system. Mm-hmm. How would you ask if barcoding is working if you're going into a system that's taxonomic terra incognita? How would I be able to convince you that we were recognized as species in those groups
right.
if no one had done any taxonomy on it? So it was absolutely critical to begin where we began, mm-hmm. which are the groups that have seen serious taxonomic attention. Things like fishes, things like birds, things like Lepidoptera. It wasn't low-hanging fruit in any way. I mean, I think it's the worst place to reveal new species. These groups have been studied intensively, but it's the best place to ask, do barcodes recover the things taxonomists called species? And I mean, if you think about Venn diagrams, our Venn diagram now is about 98% overlap. Mm-hmm. Conventional taxonomists, the things they recognize are barcode distinguishable at 98% of times. Mm-hmm. 2% of the time, we can't tell apart. The things that taxonomists have revealed, there are two explanations for that. One is barcoding is failing because of hybridization, or things previously recognized as species may not be valid species. And I think we have to entertain both those possibilities. Mm-hmm. And then we find typically at least 3%, even in the best study groups, of taxa that were overlooked. Mm-hmm. by conventional taxonomy. So the species count through barcoding and through conventional taxonomy come out to being just about equal, and guess what? Happily, just about the same entities being recognized. Mm-hmm. So,
do you expect that 98% overlap to tail downwards as you go into groups that are taxonomic?
Well, you know, so I mean, number one, you don't have anything really. So I mean, things like taconid flies and parasitoids, where we've got in to working. They are, people believe they're taxonomic complex. On the other hand, they thought they'd work things out. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing a doubling of species numbers there. Mm-hmm. In the taconid flies, there's all sorts of barcode distinct lineages. And we never make the presumption that a barcode distinct lineage is a species because we're a little early in the game to do that. Mm-hmm. What we ask is, can we find covariation with other traits? Mm-hmm. Ecological. Host plant, if it's an insect. If it's a parasitoid, the host species. Mm-hmm. And what we do is every time we see one of these barcode divergences, it's on a different caterpillar species. There's no way you can get covariation between a mitochondrial barcode and this behavioral trait without these being distinct species.
Mm-hmm. Is there, so if you go in and get the barcodes of a particular complex, uh-huh, and see that they're falling out in clusters that hadn't, yep, been suspected before, isn't there a danger in saying, well, let's go back and get the ecological information when you can just get another molecular marker?
Oh, we could. And
so isn't there a danger that you're going to just focus on molecular because it's easier to do? You can just reprocess the samples here?
I think there is a possibility that, I mean, we believe that the way in which, you know, like, you know, if you take a look at this is a really interesting thing to do. I can give you 1 minute of instruction. Or I could, my students, maybe you're dumber minded, right? You're a student. I don't think so. What I said to them is, here's a scale bar, and I want you to look everywhere, and any place you see more than 2% sequence divergence, I want you to tell me how many species there are in here. So just use this 2% cutoff rule. That's 5%. So, and I said, the only thing you have to know is ignore these distances, but add that and add that. Mm-hmm. And so if you do that, this is species 1, this is species 2, this is species 3, this is species 4, this is species 5. Mm-hmm. This is species 6, this is species 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. That's the one we're dealing with on the other page. That's species 13, that's species 14, 15, 16, and I did this in 17, 18, and I did this with a group of students, and they went through, and the number variation I got was 105, 106, 104. People completely naive, looking at nothing but barcode things. So you can count species, or you can count barcode groups that meet this rule. Mm-hmm. Are they species? Well, in this case, we could look at morphology, mm-hmm, and you're going to see morphological differences. If we had host insects, we could do that. In most cases, in many groups of the organism that haven't yet been studied, we're not going to have Janssen-esque detailed information. Mm-hmm. We're not going to have any capacity to look at the nematodes at the bottom of the ocean and ask, do they, you know, one centimeter above the other. So what do you do? If this was nematoda, I might just have a big tree here that just said nothing but nematoda on it. Mm-hmm. And to me, there will be extreme value in putting provisional names on every one of those lumps if I believe they're different species. Right now, I would not like to be so bold as to say simply look at barcode groups, but I can tell you our ground truthing studies show that you can look at this and you will find almost all of the species using this 2% threshold that would be found through taxonomy, whether it be a fish, a bird, a lepidoptera, a fly. So the really bold thing is, some years in the future, I think it may be that people, once we've ground truthed the hell out of this system, that we can simply use this as a first cut. Is it the end? Is it the end game? No. But I mean, we're at a situation of crisis, and we have no capacity inventory biodiversity on the planet today, in my view, at the scale that we need to be able to do it. So we have to change the rules. Mm-hmm. We have to accept imperfections, shortcuts, and right now, when we don't have the Janssen-esque material, the parasite, the host plant, then we use the nuclear gene approach. Nuclear gene sequences should not co-vary with mitochondrial sequences unless you've got reproductive isolation. Mm-hmm. So can I see a future where we don't have detailed morphological, ecological characteristics associated with the things we call genetically isolated units? Yes, I can, in the same way that people that work with bacteria and archaea and fungi have accepted the fact that they describe their species based on sequences. We have been seduced by morphology, the fact that the human mind thought it was large enough, and it was when it lived in a locality, you know, and was interested in the things it could eat and were poisonous to it. Our minds were big enough for that. Our minds aren't big enough to deal with global biodiversity. Mm. And I think we have to begin to think about embracing approaches that are closer to those that have been accepted by those working on organisms without a lot of morphological traits, but ours of necessity because the job is too big for the human mind to deal with, not because we couldn't do it, not because it isn't worth doing. And to me, if I just could call this nematode 1, 2, 3, 4, it wouldn't be highly exciting. Mm. On the other hand, barcoding isn't about that. Barcoding is about imaging these things. So even if I just have this as Lepidoptera 1, I will have a photograph of it. Mm-hmm. I will have GPS coordinates. I will have a way to recognize that thing, the sequence that links to that. Now I can map that species around the planet, mm-hmm, without having much more than just an outline drawing of it. And to me, that's a very important advance, to be able to take the genetic units on the planet and monitor them on a planetary scale. Mm-hmm. And, of course, all these things are also archived. So when we find a willing human mind that's prepared to devote attention to it, they can morphologically add characters to these things. It gets richer, mm-hmm, the more characters we add. And I suspect that for some groups, like Lepidoptera, we will see that done. I'm not sure we'll ever see it done for little white tubes at the bottom of the ocean, nematodes. If it's true, there are 10 million species.
That's what I was going to ask you. If we're having problems with not even 20%.
Yeah. And even, you know, these big morphologically conspicuous groups, the only thing people can identify are the adults. They can't identify, I mean, I've spent my life working on Lepidoptera in Canada, and I could never have got to the stage that I am now in terms of being able to identify these things now that we've built this library. I tapped out at about 1,000 species that I could remember. And I don't think, my brain's much smaller than other people's, I think that's about the maximum. And guess what? I can only tell adults apart. Now with barcoding, every caterpillar that falls off a tree, you know, anything is identifiable. And so it's a powerful advance, I think.
Those were excerpts from an interview with Paul Hebert, a professor at the University of Guelph, speaking with the scientist Bob Grant about DNA barcoding. Grant's feature appears in the December issue of The Scientist and will be available online at thescientist.com. Also there, check out the blogs from the scientists, writers, and editors, and vote for the best laboratory website. That's all for the Scientist Podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.